Hey, welcome back, everybody. This episode is brought to you by ProBoss.com. ProBoss.com is a statistical platform for all the basketball geeks out there that want to know more about 70 leagues and more around the world. You can choose all sorts of statistics, follow all sorts of players on the app, and starting next year, also on the platform itself, on your desktop, you can choose your favorite players and follow them across the globe. If you're interested more, please check out ProBoss.com and see you soon. On top of all that, Boris and me did a search for ProBoss.com on the platform to search his teammates and the opponents that he played against the most. We also talked about a whole bunch of other things that may interest you apart from basketball, which is photography, travel, his favorite spots in the world that he traveled to, about his boat, where it's located right now, and all sorts of other things that are not really out there. So this episode is very special. It's gold. For me, it was very enjoyable to talk about travel and coffee and wine, but also about basketball. Obviously, we talked about assistant coaches and their roles, his experiences and dealing with failure and moving on to national team duties during the summer to perform at the highest level again. This episode had everything, and I hope you enjoy it. There's a lot of good stuff in there. Thanks a lot for being here, and please subscribe. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast also on all the audio platforms as well as on YouTube. Thanks a lot for being here, and see you soon. Bye. Boris, what's up, man?
How are you?
I'm doing very good. Unfortunately, I lost my luggage, but that's how life works sometimes when you travel so much.
And it happens when you travel. You never know. It's always that little thing, you know, when you get to the airport. Is he here or is he not? Always a surprise.
And usually, because it's a longer trip, I couldn't go just with the carry-on, so I had to check it, and then. I'm driving. I hate to be late. You know, I grew up in Germany. Everything was, you know, by the book. If you're late, if you're on time, you're supposed to be there 5 to 10 minutes early. And as athletes or former athletes, you know, like you can't be there on time. You have to be there really early, you know, to be prepared and not to rush. And then I come here, they check me in. The elevator is not working. I have to ask the guy twice. Then the Wi-Fi is not connecting. I'm freaking out. And now I got to sit here with a cup of tea, unfortunately, not even coffee.
All right.
What's your, I have collected a lot of information about you, Boris. And
who are you talking to? I don't know.
I talked to a lot of people. So it's always, you know, it's, we'll explore some topics, but I know that you also, like me, you like coffee, you like wine, you like a different selection of delicacies, and I'm wondering what coffee region you prefer the most.
I mean, you know, it depends. One place that I loved and I went to was Colombia, and so I got the chance to go in Colombia. I had a friend that was living there. I went with my mom, and we did a trip, and I just loved it. I loved the country, and then especially we went to the coffee region. And we went to do the whole visit where they show you, you know, from the producing, from planting the coffee plant, from getting the coffee beans, from roasting, from the whole process. And so it was super interesting. And then we did some tasting, and it was some of the best coffee I had in my life, I think.
So this is funny. In September, I'm planning to go to Colombia to a coffee region, to a coffee roastery as well, or farm, and I'm gonna do the same thing, because I plan to do in September, like, do a South America tour, more or less, maybe some Amazon, maybe some parts of Chile. And besides coffee, there's also wine, you know. So my favorite coffee region used to be Ethiopia, and now I'm slowly drifting towards Colombia. And in wine, I prefer South American red wine. And New Zealand white wine. What's yours?
Well, Bordeaux, of course. I have to go with Bordeaux for the red wine. But I like to try different wine from different places. For the white, I go Burgundy, even though, you know, it's the big fight between Burgundy and Bordeaux. For the red, I definitely stay in Bordeaux. But for the white wine, I go to Burgundy. But I also like the white wine from New Zealand. And same thing, I got to go, and I'm going for Christmas and New Year I'm going to New Zealand. So I'm definitely gonna, you know, try some white wine over there. But yeah, there is so many places, so many different stuff. I got a chance to go to South Africa and, you know, try the white wine there. Same. I like the white. So usually red, I tend to like Bordeaux. I don't know if it's because I grew up in Bordeaux, but anywhere I go, I was like, okay, I'm going to try the local because I'm open-minded. But every time I'm like, no, there's nothing like Bordeaux. There's nothing like Bordeaux. There's nothing like Bordeaux. But when I go to try the white, then I like white from a lot of different places. I had some in Portugal that I love. Great white wine from Portugal. I had some great white wine in South Africa, great white wine in New Zealand. So I guess I'm more open-minded with the white than the red. The red, my taste is just acquired Bordeaux, probably because I'm just so used to it. So I do enjoy some of the wines from everywhere else, but mainly Bordeaux and red and white, I like to go explore.
You're very patriotic when it comes to red wine, huh? The funny thing is about white wines in New Zealand, when I was in Germany or well somewhere else, it's very rare to find New Zealand white wines. You have to really search for it. In Lithuania, I don't know how they do it, what they do. They have all the New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs, all of the possible wineries that you can imagine. And I'm just exploring every different Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand in Lithuania. So it's kind of, it prepared me for my trip when I went to New Zealand.
Yeah. I think they export a little easier, you know, and more easily as well when they go with the white wines.
Yeah, it's funny that to me this is not only the only thing that I want to explore, because I want to have all the delicacies that are going around, you know, chocolate, cheese, cocoa, and anything that's related to a delicacy that's a specialty that you can have different regions from and different parts of the world produce it. I'm trying to get my favorite region out of all of them. And I'm not there with the cheese yet. I'm with the chocolates. I'm somewhere like in Guatemala country, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and that's what is good about the different culture. They all got like a special dish. They have of like you know, special taste that they acquire. And so it's always good to go to a different country and try it.
So you travel the world a lot, and you also like to take pictures and love photography. As far as I understand, you know, your Instagram is one of the best. I mean, that the variety of nature and the mix of different parts of the world. What is there any kind of scenic country you prefer to travel to that you felt like that you remember right now?
Yeah, I mean, there is so many, and there is actually so many stuff that I haven't put on Instagram yet, and I haven't put anything in a long time for some reason. I don't really know why, but I will. For 2024, I decided I'm going to put a lot, you know, more stuff, a lot more of my travel that, you know, I did take pictures, took videos, but I didn't do anything with it. So I think I'm going to start posting a lot more in January, you know, and more related to traveling, you know, and less about basketball and all this kind of stuff. But for the places that I loved, anywhere, because I'm curious, anywhere I go, I always, you know, find something interesting to do. One that stuck with me from a long time was doing safari in Southern Africa. And it was one of the first time that I was traveling actually as vacation is when I got to the NBA. And then we had some finally time off, you know, in the summer, because even when I was in Europe and I was playing pro in Portes, you don't have a summer, you have 1 week and then you have to go play national team. So it's really when I got to the NBA, especially my first 2 years, I was done in April and didn't have national team until June or July. So I had some time. And that's when I started traveling, and I went for the first time in South Africa, and that's when I fell in love at the same time with nature and photography, and really both together. I try to capture, you know, the beauty of nature and what I see over there, and that stuck with me because same, you know, I would go just for a short period of time, but just going 2 weeks, I felt like I took a month and a half of vacation, like just because. It's such a retreat, you know, you by yourself, there is no noise, Well, at the time, there was no internet, no phone connection, so you didn't get any phone calls. Actually, I got traded. I was on a safari. I didn't know I was traded. The first time I got traded because I didn't have service and I was on a safari. So I love that about it. I love that about Africa and seeing the majestic animals in their own habitat, living their own life, you know, so much different than, you know, being in a zoo. It was just, you know, great to see them out and about and free and wild.
That's on my to-do list for sure. That's something that I always wanted to do. And I know that nature to me started to be very soothing. You know, you go there and it calms your soul. You know what I obsession, and this is maybe for the listeners or viewers, they don't know, or they, sometimes some people may do know. I have an obsession with trees.
You hugging trees?
No. I'm not that far. But I there's something, some energy or something that it's captivating. When I look at some beautiful trees, that it just stands out. It captures, and I have to capture it in a picture and with a beautiful background or a sunset or a beautiful house in the back. Sometimes it's just so scenic and photographic that it needs to be captured. I don't know what it is about trees. And there's so many, a big variety of trees in Australia and New Zealand and the beautiful, yeah, just a big variety that it's very rare on our side of the world. And you're going to enjoy New Zealand. I mean, I did the South Island with Mount Cook, with Milford Sound. I did a tour to Milford Sound and spent the night on the fjord, and then took a dip in the cold lake there. It was like 10 degrees water. It was cool, yes. Though. It's something that I will remember for New Zealand. Is really it's unique. It's unique.
I was planning yesterday the whole trip that we're going to do on South Island. So we're going to start by Auckland and then go boating around and going to South Island, and I want to do a road trip. So, you know, rented a car and going from place to place on the South Island. I'm going with my mom, so I cannot do the van. But if it was by myself, I would have to do the van trip and sleep in the van and stuff like that. But with my mom, we're just going to find, you know, so a little B&B and bed and breakfast. And it's just a little more chill. But definitely, you know, can't wait to experience, you know, those beautiful landscape that you see, you know, in Lord of the Rings and all these kind of epic movies that use New Zealand as the inspiration and to shoot the movies. So I know it's a beautiful place.
There's another winery too on the South Island there, close to Queenstown. There's some wineries. I mean, it's really cool. But another island that I liked besides New Zealand was Kauai, you know, next to Hawaii, next to
Hawaii.
Yeah, Kauai, that's where the Jurassic Park and Indiana Jones. Sorry?
Not Kawhi Leonard.
No. not the claw. So are you ready to dive into some sharing knowledge podcast?
I don't know if I have some knowledge. I'm not sure.
You do. I mean, experience is knowledge and wisdom. So there is also some information floating around, and I was thinking that fits the description of this podcast. I'm going to go circle of life. I usually do four quarters, you know, with players, with ex-players or with coaches. But with you, I'm going to do a circle of life. So we're going to go through the beginnings of your journey. That's before even basketball, just how you grew up. Then basketball in terms of critical learning with coaches, what I usually do, and then going into retirement phase and touch on different things that I wanted to talk about. But it reminds me that you know Dos Equis commercial, the most interesting man in the world.
Of course.
And I heard that you got that nickname. You're the live version of the most interesting man in the world.
Yeah, in San Antonio, they did it in one of the magazines where they call me the most interesting man in the NBA.
All right, so let's explore the most interesting man in the NBA.
Good.
You went to a Montessori school, and when you were young. So that's something that I always wondered of, how, for people who know, Montessori school impacts you in terms of creative thinking. It lets you the kids explore their fantasy in terms of teaching themselves or teaching each other, correct?
So it was kind of a Montessori. That was Montessori before Montessori, actually. So the method is different. It's called Freinet, but it's kind of the same idea. So the idea was we didn't get grades. So I didn't get grades until I was like 13 or something like that, or 12. I don't exactly what age is that. But before that, we didn't get ABCs, or we didn't get, you know, score out of 10 or score out of 20. Basically, you could pass or not pass different drills that were harder and harder, basically. So that's what it was. So you had, you know, everything that everybody's doing. You had math, geography, you had, you know, French, technology, you had art, you had all kind of different stuff. But for the learning, basically, and what it does, and I love it. I love that I did that kind of school, and I think he helped me a lot, is that each kid self choose how much work he's going to do that week. Mm-hmm. Basically, the teachers are still there, first of all, to help you if you got a problem and the math problem is too hard. They hear also to make sure that you're not, you know, lazy and like, okay, I'm going to do one drill. But basically, it's like, okay, you and your learning speed, because everybody's different and we're in a class and it's 25 kids, you know, five might, you know, learn super fast and they're going to do a total during the week of 25 drills, you know, 25 exercise. Mm-hmm. When somebody else is going to do only 20, when somebody else that's going to learn slower is going to have time to do 15, but he has to complete the 15. And basically, each beginning of each week, you're going to decide, okay, this week, I'm going to do two exercises of French, three of math, one of geography, one of, and then you choose like this, first of all, the topics that you want to do. The teacher is also there to make sure that you did cover all the topics at the end of the year. But you can do, you know, three of math, two of French, only one of geography this week. And then maybe the next week, the teacher is going to be like, okay, you did already those French and you did good. Do you want to do two of geography this time? And, you know, one of math. And so they kind of steer you one direction, but you really feel empowered by like, okay, I'm choosing that this week I can do 13. And then if you do 13, it's good. If you don't do 13 and you did only 11, you know, you're like, ah, I could have do more. And if you can do 15 or 16 and you say 13, you're super happy. And because you choose yourself that number, that push yourself to say, okay, I want to make it. I'm the one that say 15. It was not imposed by the teacher to tell me you got to do 15 exercise. So if I say myself, I'm going to do 15, you know, it's like when you're happy, when you finish something, when you finish a job, when you do something good, you're happy about yourself, about a self-achievement. And so it's kind of like that, because you could choose how many drills you would do. So now you would really focus to finish that. And even if you start slow during the week and you're like, oh, I got 2 days left and I got still 8 exercises to do. And then you, you know, fasten up and do it. And better, you know, whether you do it or you do or you don't, but everybody is different. Everybody has a different pace. And now the guy in the class that's like super smart is not slowing down the guy. Is not being slowed down by the rest of the class and going the same speed, because maybe he's going to do 35 drills, 35 exercise, yeah, because he's advanced. But the guys that's 15 also is not going to be left over by the rest of the class because he's slow learning. And the rest of the class, if they super fast, then he doesn't learn nothing, you know, in a regular school.
Yeah.
Because he goes, the whole class is going too fast for him. At least this way, he does his 15 exercise. He doesn't do the 35 like the other guys, but he doesn't be left over by the rest of the class going too fast. And then the teacher is going to spend more time with him, try to help him to catch up and make more and more exercise. Anyway, the whole process I thought, you know, was really cool and helped me, you know, planify myself, be confident about, you know, how much I can do and what I can do, make me responsible about, you know, choosing and making, you know, of my time, how much time do I have, you know, what do I need to do, and I cannot, you know, be lazy for too long because I know I got this much time to finish the job. And so it's just, you know, learning, you know, in life. And then it was the same, you know, when you get money, you're responsible of it, and you have to look at all these different aspects as well. So that prepares you for life, I think.
So there's a couple of things I wrote down that jumped to me right away, because there's a couple layers to that. So you said it teaches you to be responsible, accountable, and to take matters into your own hand. And then And there's a little bit of competition in there. I feel like I'm trying to always relate to basketball a little, mm-hmm. because you're trying to compete against the number that you set to yourself.
Yes.
And then you're trying to achieve it and maybe overachieve a little bit. And then next time overachieve again a little bit.
Yeah.
So I'm always.
And it could also be competition with, you know, okay, my friend did 17, I did only 15 this week. I was like, oh, I'm going to try to beat him next week as well. So exactly. You can have also the competition with the guys, but you don't get left behind. You know, when a competition is too hard for you to compete.
Exactly. No, there's a lot of value in that. And the first thing you said was even more interesting, I think. And that's maybe a little philosophical avenue that I'm trying to think right now, because you said that you didn't get grades until you were 12 or 13, yep. something like that. So to me, that's something that you don't get judged. Right. So exactly. that influences a young person when they don't get judged too early. It gives them a freedom to express themselves and does not give them in some sort of fear, you know. So you
kind
of
doesn't bring you down. For everybody that doesn't get the good grade, I think grade is good for everybody that got the super grades. Everybody else, it brings you down somehow. If you got a B, you're just not happy. You have an A. If you have a D, a C, a D, or E, then it really brings you down. You just think, "Fuck, I'm dumb. I'm never going to do anything." So that's the first thing. And then the fact that you don't get the grade, forget what I was going to say. The second thing is, okay, go ahead. Keep going. I remember.
No, it's a thing that you feel that it can hold you back, you know, and you can grow up with complexes within you that you feel like people are judging you or you get a bad grade. And then you can either, some people can reverse it from, I was an average student. And then when I came to the US, it was got better. Let's say in college, from freshman to senior, I went from C's, B's to all A's by the time I graduated. So it was kind of the reverse. It was sometimes, you know, it can tilt other way. It can tilt to like, I'm, you know, you see all this freedom in college, you're by yourself, there's nothing holding you back, and you just kind of deteriorate. So it depends, I think, also on the person of how much you can apply yourself, and maybe you compete with yourself, and you find like a little... I'm missing the word too now. You get addicted to it. You get addicted. It's like it's an addiction of getting another A, and you're trying to push yourself to the next limit. And that's sometimes it can work both ways. And it's
but
just,
the thing also I think is like the grade doesn't tell you if you can solve the problem or not. And that's why I was saying, I was like, they didn't give you a grade. It's either you pass the exercise or you don't. Like, you're gonna have three different level of exercise of mathematics.
Right.
You know, you're going to have level 1, 2, 3, whatever. If you have a grade, let's say you have, you know, 15 out of 20. Okay, I have 15 out of 20 in math. Do you know how to do it or you don't know how to do it? Like, you know, if it's something as simple as 3 plus 2 minus 5, can you do it or can you not do it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not the fact that you get a grade. Like, if you, you know, 15 point out of 20 on this kind of stuff is like, oh, he can do it sometime and sometime he can't. But the idea is like, you know, you can't do it or you have to do it. Same thing in French or same thing, you know, in geography or whatever. It's like, do you know it or do you don't?
Yeah, that's the creativity part is interesting to me, because you're expressing yourself. You know, you do whatever exercises you have. You also have a little bit, you're also in nature, as far as I understand. There's a lot of outside activities.
There's a lot of outside activities. There is a lot of creativity activities. I think, you know, half of the school was, you know, the regular note exercise and stuff like that. And then usually in the afternoon, that's when you go art and you're going to be, you know, like do like a mold or, you know, something, or, you know, sculpture or something like that. You're going to paint, or you're going to build something, or you're going to go outside and it's going to be. Yeah, so there is also a lot of artistic part of it and creativity. That's usually half of the day.
So all this creativity that you had the chance to express yourself and do different exercises, how did that transfer to the court when you became a basketball player? Did it help you in some sense to be not afraid to make mistakes and to be open more? Because you were very... creative passer, very finesse, and you saw the court in a different angles of the game. I was wondering if that creativity kind of helped you to be yourself on the court as well.
I mean, I think it does. It's hard to pinpoint exactly, you know, how much he had an effect or in what area has an effect. But I mean, yeah, you the experience of whatever you've been grew up and you've done. So, you know, being creative, I think, yeah, part of it probably was, you know, from school and from being able to do this kind of thing. So I think it helps, yeah.
Because it's there was risky passes involved, you know, and you growing up where you're allowed to make mistakes and you're not being judged, I think it frees up a different aspect, different angle of your personality as well. And you're explorative, you know, off the court, on the court, you're more open to different experiences. And that way on the court, you're also more open to not being afraid to make a mistake.
Yeah, but I was not, you know, a daredevil either on the court like I do, you know, or this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I was still careful. I was still the guy that wasn't, you know, taking too many risks either. And I could, you know, manage the risk reward aspect of it. But yeah, I think it's more the managing risk reward was more of an aspect that I had being able to, yeah, maybe trying some things.
So moving on slowly to the career and the circle of life, we're shifting slowly towards basketball, and the impact that coaches have on you are big, you know, whether it's youth coaches, especially, it's a big responsibility. And I think a lot of federations or a lot of countries and say they take it for granted. And sometimes they put too young of coaches to coach young players who, you know, to teach the wrong fundamentals, or they don't have the background to do it. But besides that, which coaches influenced you the most in the past? Do you think which part of which generation would think you felt like was most impactful?
I think a lot in a lot of different ways, and they know they all did. Basically, when I won, so 2014, so towards the end of my career, when I won the ring. I met the replica that you can do all the replicas for family, friends, and stuff like that. And so I met the special one that you put like an office inside, like a crystal or something. And I gave to all the different coaches that I had growing up and building up to, you know, wherever I was and the way I was now. And so, yeah, I think a lot of them in so many different ways. The first coach that I ever had, you know, just brought the joy and the passion, because when you're a kid, the first thing you want to do is play and have fun. And the guy was just all about fun. Yeah.
What age?
When I was 11, you know, 12-year-old.
Yeah.
So this one was all about the passion and the fun and making jokes and during practice. And I would just remember that. Of course, you know, we were like kids and acting up. So he make us doing push-ups and stuff. But all we remember, and all my friends are the same, because, you know, still have the same friends from that time. All we remember is, you know, the joy that we had. We were just laughing and having fun on the court at that time. So that was, you know, the first one I think is the more important. And then, you know, you want to develop and get better. And so I had some others that could do the same, you know, be tough on you. And at the same time, you could, you know, feel the love from your coach. It's like tough love, you know, and stuff like that. So I had that as a young age as well. And that definitely, you know, helped me. And then all the coaches that I had after that, everybody is bringing a different aspect. Everybody's bringing something of the player you become. So that's why, like, all these coaches are all, you know, got him a ring for that, because they were part of it.
That's really cool. Yeah, that really, and that shows you of how impactful and how important it is to for youth coaches, you know, to invest in the kids, because what you said earlier, at the early age, young guys, that when they start playing, they have to have fun. You can't drill them. You can't drill them to make them robots. They're gonna lose the joy. They're gonna lose the fun, and you may lose out on some talents. You know, so at the young,
I might have stopped. That's why I said the first coach is so important. Like, if it was not fun, I might have stopped playing basketball when I was 12. You know, so
exactly,
the first couple of years are super important.
Exactly, that's a pathway to keep everybody, all the talents, alive, let's say, and, you know, to keep them on path, and then they can still decide if they want to go a different direction, because there's some, you don't want to lose them to other sports, you know, you don't want to lose them to somebody else who brings them in, they having fun, they have they enjoying what they do, and then you lose possibly basketball talents for your country. So that's, I think that's important in the grassroots, when you teach coaches to
super important.
Yeah. What's the expectation for you when you were in the NBA, when you were working with high-level assistant coaches? Not only head coach, obviously Pop was very a big figure and is very impactful and still is a big figure in terms of mentoring young players and mentoring players that are from Europe. You know, just it's all known, obviously. But what role did assistant coaches play to you?
Yeah, so me, it happened, you know, before the Spurs. Like I say, when I arrived to the Spurs, I was already, you know, towards the end of my career. I've been in the NBA already for 10 years when I arrived basically to San Antonio. But definitely a big role. I mean, you know, the coach has the job of managing the team and everything. And so the person that you have the most contact with, and there is always, you know, that one assistant that you're close to, and that is the one that you relate to, that is the one that you complain to, that is the one that's going to give you the advice when you're acting up and fucking up anyway, and that you're going to, you know, trust with whatever is going to tell you. So super important, you know, that relationship with one assistant. If you don't have, you know, that relationship with an assistant on the team, I think it's, you know, bad for everybody, bad for the team, bad for you. So it's always good to find, you know, the one guy that you talk to. And I had one, you know, in every team I've been. And even when it was like, you know, tough season and season that I didn't like, I was, you know, I had, you know, that one assistant that you can relate to, talk to, and have a, you know, good relationship with.
Is there something good assistant coaches or assistant coaches in general, there's some do's and don'ts that come to mind of what, let's say, what not to do, because everybody knows what you have to do, but something that you feel like from assistant coaches, what there's something they're not to do. Because I remember when I was a young assistant coach still in Germany, second division, and we're going to a road game, and it's ingrained in me right now. It's I don't forget it, because it impacted me of understanding the moment and understanding what the players are going through right now. We're on the road playing against a good team, and we started off like 2-13, you know, like a terrible run that they had, and they were obviously better than us, and they're coming off the floor, and I'm like, what the hell are we doing as an assistant coach, you know? And then it's like, yes. and the coach,
yeah,
is like,
we don't do that.
He said, that's not what we need right now. That's not what we need right now. And I'm like, all right. And it just kind of, you know, it put me aside. I was still like 20. I just stopped playing, so I was like 25.
Because the job of the assistant is the opposite, basically. Like, yeah. That's the job of the head coach. If you do that, if you're 2-13 and you're fucking up, and you know, first quarter or whatever, you're shitty, and that's the job of the head coach. You should do that, you know.
Yeah.
And so if the assistant does it, then you lose that complicity. You lose that relationship that you have also with the players. But at the same time, don't be, you know, just the friend that's just a yes man, you know, to the players. What you owe the player, you know, when your assistant is also, you know, the truth, you know, to be able to tell him when he's not doing good, to be able, it's not just, you know, oh, okay, it's all right. Oh, no, you're good. Don't worry, you know, because, yeah, if the coach is saying they're not doing good, you know, you're not just there to tell them they're not doing good. They're doing good, yeah. And saying the opposite of what the coach is saying anyway. But you should be, like I said, a role of that person that the player can trust, because it's fair, not because just you're always nice with him or always agree with the player. Because, you know, you talk enough and you're close enough that you can tell him the truth. but at the same time, yeah, you're not the one that's, you know, just yelling out of the gym and stuff, because that's the job of the coach. And
yeah.
Then you have to, you know, let him know that, yeah, you know, of course we're not doing good. I'm not going to tell you we're doing good, but hang in there, grind it, and, you know, we'll do better.
Yeah, that's something that not all assistants, sometimes assistants also, they're like you said, there's a lot of yes men, you know, they're just afraid to say something that's contrary to what the player is feeling. But do you, because you know Lasse Tovi, who is the head coach of Finland and now the assistant coach for Virtus Bologna, he said that when he goes talk to veterans or veteran players, he is more keen on listening to them because they have much, much more experience. And he asks them questions of what they see and what to do. What do you think about that? What's your relationship with when coaches come up to you and ask you what you see?
I mean, you know, it's both. If you don't agree, you can say it as well. But it's way easier to have like a full, you know, discussion and a debate. You know, like I say, if he goes to an older guy and he has his own experience and he sees the thing maybe a different way, like you say, maybe listen and try to, you know, work it out together, debate about it, and then you figure out that maybe you're right. I mean, maybe the older guy is, even though he's a veteran, he's got a lot of experience, he might still be wrong. Even though you're a younger coach and maybe you have less experience than some of the players, you might still be right. But the other way around as well, you know, he might still know some different things. And usually by talking about it, whereas a young guy sometimes is different because, you know, that's the DNA of a young guy. You think he knows everything. you know, you still, you know, can debate and talk about it and you know, let him know different things. But sometimes it's harder to, you know, find the truth or, you know, find common ground. But I think, yeah, you're right. You still need, you know, to say what you think. But definitely there is some players that have been playing, you know, 15, 17, 20 years. If you've been coaching for three, maybe he knows a little more.
Maybe, yeah. That's why I'm big on communication. It's really of how you approach the player and how you express yourself, because you have to feel the words that are coming out of your mouth. And the older I get, the more I got aware of how I'm being perceived of what I'm saying. You know, it has to be really constructive, but also precise to the point. So the player gets that, like, you have to break it down in layers, and to every player you communicate in a different way. But there is a certain way that not even language barrier, but it's a certain vocabulary that you have to use for certain players to get their attention and to have them show them the other layer that they may not be able to see, because video proof is the best proof that came, and you can't fool that.
Yeah, you cannot lie on video. I think it's one of the most important things is to be precise, especially with a veteran. Because if you're coming up, like you say, the vocabulary or whatever you're saying, and you're not precise on what you're doing, and when they come back at you with a question, you have, like, you know, some unanswered question mark, then the player is going to sense that. It's going to be like, okay, he doesn't know his subject. He doesn't control the subject and know exactly what he's talking about, basically. So it's very important to be precise and to be prepared. And it is a lot of work, you know, on the side, but definitely when you want to, you know, get to some certain subjects that you want to talk about, and it comes with experience too, you know. After a while, you don't need to prepare for it because you have the experience of, and you can, you know, just talk about any subject and know what you talk about because you have. You know, like you were saying, like, okay, I got this experience of this, of doing this or doing that. And so that's stuff that comes up to your mind that, you know, you can be precise about something and convey that thought.
What's your relationship with pressure? Did it ever bother you? Did you have a certain approach to big games?
No, I usually embrace it. I think it's good. I think that is what I play for. So Drew, the adrenaline that you have in those games with a lot of pressure is actually what I thrive. Like, I love that. Like, if I'm going to play a game with no pressure and friendly games and I was even, you know, telling coaches at the end of my career, like, regular season game, because it's 82 games. It's good. They did the in-season tournament now. Yeah. That kind of, you know, brings a little bit of excitement in the beginning. But if not a game in December, regular season, it's like,
it's the dog days.
It didn't bring the best out of me, for sure, because I didn't have that adrenaline. I didn't have that pressure. And I love that. And that's what I loved also, you know, in international games, because every game is super important. It's like you start with the playoffs. That's a big difference. So, yeah, I love it. I like the pressure. I think it's better. It makes you more focused on everything. More precise. You got to be more precise on everything you're doing. And then every game, you try to do the least mistake as possible.
So perfect transition, national team. We're moving the cycle, keep going. And that cycle of pain is also something that a lot of players struggle with, you know, after loss in the finals, for example, that we're not going to get into, but to moving on to the transition, you know, and dealing with the pain, dealing of the 2013 finals, and then moving on and playing in a national team, the transition period of forgetting of what happened and moving on to this, you know, glorious run in 2013. How was your relationship with that pain and that transition for the national team? What was the decision-making process to play that summer?
I mean, decision making to play. It's every summer I played. Like, I didn't have, it was not even a process. Like, I wanted
no, to play no doubt summer. About it, huh?
No, I wanted to play every summer anyway. So it doesn't matter what happened during the season. But the mindset to get into the other, I think it brings hunger, you know, not anger, hunger. Mm-hmm. You know, you have appetite for winning. Just losing the final and the way we lost it and being like, oh shit, like not, you know, not getting the championship. You're like, okay, you know, let's go back at it. And then, and you want to win. I mean, you want to win so bad. And that carried on. Actually, it was the summer, but also the year after with the Spurs and what led us to win the championship again. at the end of that year as well. It was actually everything in 12 months, you know, like we won the European Championship and NBA Championship, you know, all reunited together for me was like the greatest year. So yeah, that's what it brings. You know, I mean, you prepare all year and in every competition, you prepare either all summer and then practice together, do a lot of sacrifice, don't go on vacation because you want to get to that moment when you can win. And so when you don't, it's like, you know, did I really do everything to be able to win this? How can I do better next time? And it all started all over again. And so same thing after winning the final and working all year to get to this final and getting into the summer, just being like, okay, now we got to do everything, you know, in our power and do all the sacrifice and do everything to be able to win a championship.
So let's talk about the 2013 EuroBasket Championship, because I tell a lot of people this story and I feel I need some confirmation from the inside about this. And it's something that I feel it's a championship DNA type of thinking that the 2000. So there's two parts to this question. One thing was the 2011 loss in the finals that you guys had. And the impact that it had on your mindset going into the finals of 2013 against us, that's the first part of how you processed it and how much you remembered that versus also seeing us emotionally emotionally really happy after 2013, after the semifinals when we beat Croatia and we advanced to the finals. And that for us, that was something that was, you know, I can compare it to this summer of when we beat the US. We just emotionally let everything go. And then we had a young team. It was very, very hard to collect all those emotions together again and to prepare yourself for the next game. You can front. You can say like you're doing it. You know, you forget about what happened and you just kind of, we're ready for the next game. But in reality, you left a lot of your soul on that game that you just won and the celebration or the happiness, the happiness factor in the locker room, which is all normal, but to a degree, you have to keep it inside. So I'm wondering of those two parts, that 2011 loss and the memory of it at breakfast on the final, on the day of the finals.
Yeah, that's the same. They're related. You know, the both are related, the way that we saw that you were happy and the way that we were in 2011. Basically, in 13, we saw in Lithuania, us in 11. Because in 11, it's what happened. We want to get to the final, and we were just so happy. We didn't get to the final in 50 years or something like that with France. So it was like historical for us to get to the final, and we were just ecstatic and super happy. And at the same time, we know we got a final. We're like, okay, let's not get overexcited. But like you say, you can say it. You can meet about it. You can talk about it in practice. We can all players come together like, look, now it's a final. Let's not get, we know we happy we get to the final, but let's get focused. It's just, you have to experience it. And that's the tough part. And then, the problem is even we said it in 2011, when we said it in 13 was very different because we lived it in 11. And so we could use that experience. And so if it's not the same team, like you say, the team now that did it against the US now, yeah, but it's not the same one that was here in 2000. It's not the same people. It's not the same players that was here in 13. So they haven't lived it. You can say, oh, look, our ancestors lived it, you know. 10 years ago. It doesn't relay because it didn't hurt you personally inside, you know, in your heart that it hurt so much, you know, to lose that final. It's after leaving that you can have, you know, the experience to the next time we won the semifinal. It's almost we're not even happy because of what happened 2 years before. If it was the first time that we won the semifinal and went to the final in 13, we probably would have been as much, you know, ecstatic as Lithuania. Now we both, so maybe it's, you know, game.
We faced each other already in the second stage, and we it is hard to beat the same team two times because we won against what are these balloons? Do you see these balloons on mine?
No, yeah. Is it because I cough?
I don't know. I don't know if it's gonna be whatever the balloons are on my screen. I don't know what that is. But that it's hard to beat the same team twice in the same tournament. That's one thing. But the more painful thing was after moving on was that we did the same thing in 2015, you know, and it was another layer that we had a couple new players. There was the core was still there from 2013, but it was still a little bit different because you qualified already for the Olympics as well. So there was another pressure release, you know. So it's a big psychological challenge, I think, for teams and players, especially in leadership positions. You have to have a veteran team to bring it together and to keep the mind in place.
And we had the same when we beat the US in 19 in a World Cup, and then we lose against Argentina in semifinal. That's the thing, you know. You can talk about it, you can share your experience, but sharing your experience is sharing by talking about it. You cannot share the feeling. You know, you have to feel it for yourself.
Yeah, that's the experience part that everybody that went through it hopefully carries on with it. So we're moving on slowly to retirement. And my thought process was, or my question was, what was your thought process? What was the approach that you had leading into retirement? And how did you make the final decision of moving on to the next stage of your life?
Well, I knew you had to prepare, you know, for a retirement. The one thing that's, you know, scary for a professional athlete retiring and stuff is to not be prepared and to get bored. Because, you know, we got enough money to retire. That's not, you know, some people preparing retirement is preparing enough money to leave. We have that. We have enough money to leave. But now, you know, what are we going to do with our life? And so, I mean, it could be tough. There is, you know, some mental health and all this kind of stuff. So we're being prepared and, you know, talk about, especially in NBA, we got all these meetings. I'm going to tell you to get prepared, do different stuff. So, I mean, I'm of nature curious anyway. I always, you know, like to know, discover and stuff. So I knew I wanted to travel. I knew I wanted to see different things. I was also scared to be bored. I was like, what if, you know, I'm home for like 10 days and then I'm looking at the wall. I'm like, what am I doing? So you don't want to get bored. I wanted to travel and I love to travel and I can do it nonstop, basically. When a lot of people, they like travel for a little bit, it's like, oh no, I gotta, you know, settle down, be at home for like a month or something. I was like, no, I can move different place, you know, every 2 days. But that's luck that, you know, I'm made that way. So I did prepare for that. I was like, okay, I want to travel. I want to go to different places. And 5 years before I retired, I was like, okay, you know, when I retire, I didn't even know what was the date. Obviously, I was like, I retire somewhere in 5, 6, 7 years. I don't know. but what do I want to do then? And I already love, you know, traveling, taking pictures, going to different countries. And scuba diving. Scuba diving was another one that I really loved. And then I was like, going around the world, if you have time, you know, you don't do it by plane. If you have time, you do it by boat. You go to all the best spots in the world, you know, by boat. And so I was like, yeah, probably, you know, going to try to do sailing boat, take my time and go. I went to experience, I went on a sailing catamaran that was doing diving trips. And I was like, that's the perfect setup. Like they have everything to dive on their own. They don't need a dive center, which means you can dive remote places. You don't need a dive center somewhere. You can dive where nobody never dove before. And, you know, be completely, you know, self-reliant by having your apartment floating and wake up in a different place every day. So that was, you know, right away appealing to me. And then to prepare that, I went and researched everything and different kind of boat, different size, what I wanted to do.
That's so cool.
And so that's when I went for it. And to know when I was going to retire, I mean, you know, I tried to play, you know, as much as possible, but then I played. So I got traded to Utah my last year, got to Utah, loved Utah, loved the place, still got my house there. And I decided to make it, you know, my home in the US. So when I go back in the US, I go back to Utah. I didn't know, you know, when I was going to stop. So I played my last year, and it was an option for the team to keep me or release me. And that year, and I didn't get hurt my whole career, basically, pretty much. And I did get like a small fracture on my leg. And so I didn't play a good part of the season. And I came back towards the end of the season and just played the playoffs. And then they decided to go another direction, go younger and go with young guys. And, you know, I could understand, you know, the position and why they did it. And I was still hoping, you know, to come back to a team. So I went back to France, play for Paris, Levallois, mm-hmm. for 6 months. I was like, okay, I never lived in Paris, you know, my adult life. And I was like, it would be nice, you know, to be in Paris and enjoy and, you know, being playing with friends. It was two guys that I play with national team that was coaching, Sacha Giffa and Freddy Fautou. So I was like, you know, that'd be cool to be there in Paris with those guys that I appreciate. And if an NBA team towards the end of the season, you know, needs somebody, maybe I could go back. And I almost did. It was a team that was thinking about it. And they didn't bring me in at the end for the playoffs, but almost.
Okay. I'm not going to ask which one. We're going to keep it on the low. So you have, what I feel is you have a very easy way of looking at things. It doesn't feel like you're emotionally very balanced in terms of approaching it and not really, you know, having concern about having a different identity shift, because there's a preparation, like you said. There is
centering the career, like you say, balance. I didn't want to go too high. I didn't want to go too low. I never was too happy. I never was too unhappy. I like to be even keel.
Yeah, that's, you can sense that, because a lot of and I don't have that. I have that emotional high and very, very much emotional low after a bad summer with the national team or something else privately happens. It's just very, very fluctuating, and I'm trying to learn the way of balancing the emotions. And that's something that I ask usually former players of, you know, what kind of deprogramming did you have to do? Because there's some learned behaviors you have as a player that you can't use in regular life, you know, like emotional control, anger, you know, in the court, there's so much competitive drive, competitiveness, that in real life, they look at you crazy if you're losing your mind somewhere, complaining about certain things, you know, like on court, referee does something, you just lose your mind, and somebody in check-in does not know what they're doing.
So that's the thing. Already in my career, I was, you know, even balanced, even keel. And so it was the same. It's the way to see things, you know, everything is relative. So I relativize everything and just think that, you know, could be worse or could be better or could be, you know, so I'm like, that's how I make it easy. That way, the one thing that you miss the most from the game, yeah, is the competitiveness and the adrenaline that you have from the game. So what I was telling that I love about, you know, playing was the pressure of the playoffs, of the finals and everything. And that's why when I came back, I could have played longer, you know, in first division in France. I could have played a couple more years, even though my body was like hurting everywhere, you know, knees, back and everything. But I didn't find that again, you know, from when I left the NBA. I didn't find again that pressure and everything that you could feel, and that adrenaline that on the court playing those big games on the highest level, on the highest stage. So that you miss. And then you try to find by other things to have adrenaline, you know. And like I say, I love diving, and I love, like, you know, some tech diving, some stuff that are a little more pushy, you know. The sailing sometimes can be adrenaline, and then you're getting some seas. So it's also, you know, keep me balanced in some of that. And then I like, you know, to give myself like a couple projects and stuff. I hike Mont Blanc the year I retired, 1 year after I retired. So, you know, for my big body. And then I was already eating a lot that 1 year after this after retired. So it was tough for me to get to the top. So I always, you know, find some stuff that's going to, you know, keep me alert, keep me competitive, keep the adrenaline going a little bit.
Keep you on your toes. How many days did you have to climb? How long did it take?
It's 3 days, and then you go, and then you stop, and then you go, you stop, and then you go again. There is different stage where you find and sleep in altitude, but it was long. I had huge blisters. I didn't have the right equipment because I had to make custom-made shoes. It took 1 year to make the custom-made shoes for climbing because I couldn't find my size anywhere.
Yeah.
And so I received them 1 week before I went. So I couldn't, you know, when you make the shoes and make them use. So it was like brand new shoes to climb up. So big blisters. It was tough. It was tough. And it was, yeah, high, long, just going up the whole time, very steep. So, but it was one of the hardest things I had to do physically, you know, in my life. Because it's long, you know, a game is 2 hours and you have some tough game when you get out of the game and you're dead tired, but here you go for 3 days. So it was one of the hardest thing, but also, you know, super happy I did it.
Yeah, that's also on my to-do list, climbing a mountain. That's something that I will do at some point. How is playing in the 11th division in France? How is that treating you, and how is that coming?
13. You sure it's 11th?
Oh, maybe my information is not correct.
National 1, National 2, National 3, R1, R2, R3, D1, D2, D3. Yeah, 11.
11. Okay. Yeah, you're right. All right. You're right. How is that treating you? How did you
tough,
come about?
It's tough. Well, you play against teams that are above us, you know, like 5th division, you know, 6th division. But it's good, you know, it's good fun. The main idea was to play with some of my friends. And so, you know, like I was saying, I'm playing with guys that I used to play with when I was 12, 13, 14 years old. And so it's good to be back, you know, together after 25 years. Last time we played together was 26 years ago. And then go and take on to this challenge. And it's fun.
That's awesome. How's Simon's knees?
Simon's knees are fucked up. Like, he cannot. He's limping the whole time. He's going to tell you, "Hey, I'm good. But after 5 minutes, he's limping. The first 5 minutes is okay. And then he's limping the whole time.
Sounds like me. Sounds exactly like me, I guess. We had a pickup with the staff a couple of years ago, and Brad Stevens had it. We played 3-on-3 in the summer when there was some lag time. And you know, when Brad Stevens wants to play, you kind of want to play too, you know. And we played the older guys against the younger guys in the office, and they needed one more person. And I was like, "All right, I'm going to do it." All right. Man, and we were up 3-0. Like, the series was to best of 7, and we were up 3-0. And I was hitting on all cylinders, one game, two games, and then slowly started deteriorating. And we lost the series 4-3. My knee was swollen. My knee was swollen like this for like a month. And I had to go to vacation to Bali with my girlfriend at that time. And it was like, and my back, everything just collapsed for that one hour of basketball just killed me. And I was just... Dead.
That's the worst, actually. If you go from nothing to everything, you have to go slowly.
Right now. I thought I was warmed up, but I was not ready for that. Okay. And then the competitiveness takes the better of you. You forget about your body.
Of course. Well, you have to.
So our common friend, Benoit Desjardins, he's also a sponsor of mine with ProBallers.com, which you also use, as I understand. You have the app.
Yeah, I have the app, and it's interesting because you can, you know, follow all the players, and then, you know, especially follow all the players from the national team and try to see what they're doing around the world. And so, yeah, I just choose, you know, basically all the favorite, you know, my favorites is all the French guys from the national team. And then that way I can, you know, just in one look, look at everything.
So that's a function that's only on the app right now. But I think they're going to have it. I was told that they're going to have this information also, or this function also on the websites in 2024. So next year on the website, they can do it as well. I'm going to share my screen for you.
Yep.
And we're going to do a little search. Going to have some fun here. And we'll see if you You see my screen?
Yes.
Okay. So now I'm gonna enter your name.
Uh-oh.
And we're gonna free contact ad blocker didn't work again. All right. So now your I think that's the easy one. So your top teammate that you played with all time, the most games with.
Oh, I need to find out.
Yeah, what's your best guess?
Oh, the guy that I played the most game with?
Together, yep.
Wait, Tony?
Tony, 100%. I mean, it's not even close.
Yeah.
So Danny Green was the
first guys? Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Tony, Danny Green, Tim Duncan. And
Florent,
yeah.
Pietrus, yeah.
He's right there. So, because there's a lot of national
team. We played 240 or 230 games together in national team with Florent. So,
wow.
Yeah. So, and Tony, same. We played 200 games together plus 300 with San Antonio. That's why we're so far.
So if we go here now into Tony, there's the, like you said, the 149 national team games here.
Yep.
347 with the Spurs and 6 at the under 18s. You guys won this under 18s, right?
Yes, we did.
What did you remember from the final?
Amazing. The last basket from Ronny Chariaf. We went after 2 overtime against Croatia in Croatia. It was nuts. And Dino Raja was at the game.
Oh, wow.
It was crazy. Yeah.
So another function here, if we go into opponents, that's something maybe more challenging. So the opponent you played against the most.
I want to say Pau Gasol.
International is correct. International, but it's a different international player.
Dirk? No.
Yes. Dirk.
Yeah.
Dirk is up top. Vince.
Ooh, by one. Vince Carter is second. Okay. Yeah.
And then you got Jamal and Matt Barnes, and then we're going down the list here.
Everybody's close after that, 50 times because all the guy times in NBA.
Yep. Yep. Wow. You have all these games. Fun games.
Yeah.
All right, so this is the segment.
Yeah, Dirk, I'm glad you don't have the stats of Dirk against me because kicked my ass so many times.
he kicked a lot of people's ass, man. That was
toughest guy I had to play in my career.
Really? Was that toughest one to guard?
Yeah, I always say it's different because I play a different position. So when I was playing forward, the two guys I had the hardest time against was Kobe and T-Mac. And when I was playing power forward, it was Dirk and Kevin Garnett, and then Tim was playing the five. So I don't put Tim in there because I was more playing the five. I usually wasn't guarding him, but Dirk and Garnett scored a lot of basket in my face for sure. And T-Mac and Kobe, no idea which way they were going to go, or what they were going to do on the court. It was hard to guard.
Yeah, I can imagine teammate and Kobe is just it. Yeah.
I played 3,000 guys in my career.
Yes, 3,026 opponents.
That's a lot. Wow. I didn't know they had all these actually. Because I was only using the app. I wasn't using the website. I'm gonna use the website now.
Yeah, there's a lot of fun tools on here. There's a lot of fun tools. Do you remember when Dirk's game took another level when you played again, because you guys had a lot of parallel career was going at the same time, that there's
those but he was already, when I arrived in the NBA, it was already Dirk. Like,
he was already Dirk.
Yeah, because I mean, yeah, when I was in Atlanta a couple of years, but when I was in Phoenix, we were battling with him. He beat us the first year out of the playoffs. I did score 25 a game against them though in a conference final. It wasn't guarding me either.
We gotta sneak that one in. We gotta sneak that one in for sure. this platform is fun to use. There's a lot of goodies on here. So I recommend everybody to go to the website as well. And as I said, next year they're gonna have the function of also putting your favorite players on there and following them easily on your desktop. So to move on, and usually I do I do ATOs at the end. So I don't draw a place, but I'm going to shoot quick questions at you. And the first thing that pops into your mind that you feel like that is
that's when you say something you don't want to say.
They're not,
think about it. Go ahead.
They're not that crazy. They're very humane. So the most memorable bucket with your left hand, Boris.
I was telling somebody, and he did not believe me. I don't know if you can find that on Pro Bowlers. I don't think I ever scored a bucket with my left hand.
Wow.
Ever. Ever. Nothing that I remember. I know with the Spurs I didn't. You can check that with Chip England because he was counting. He's counting all the offhand buckets. And, you know, at the end of the week, he was like, okay, the guy that scored the most offhand bucket is, and then it's always somebody. And it was like a ranking. And I was always last, always zero. And then I never scored one offhand. And one time he put one offhand, but I don't think it was like a bucket. It was more like a tip in. You know, the ball was coming out and I just basically tapped in and it went in. But I don't count that. And if I don't count this one, I don't think I ever made a left-hand bucket in my career. We can tell everybody now because they cannot scout me anymore. I'm retired. But I never did. All you had to do was take off my hand, my right hand.
So, okay. All right. Let me sidetrack that.
I should have told that Lithuania in 2013.
So I'm going to make a pause on these ATOs right now. And I'm going to ask you what, because, you know, you prepare a game plan. And when he turns to that, to his left shoulder, you got to be there on the trap. Or you make him think about it. You make him turn the other way. You got to keep him guessing. What was the best way to defend your right hand?
I don't know, somebody found out. I remember, and Tony was telling me that Pop was going nuts when I was going to score because it's like, if Boris is going down the middle, you know, and scores his right hand, I take you off the court. And every game, I was doing it every game. I would go left. I just wouldn't shoot with my left hand. So I could drive left and then do the quick right hand, you know. So I would drive left and then go quick like this. Or then I would fake going to the left and then come back to the middle. Or when I go left, I would you know, fade away and shoot with my right. But I would never go finish with my left hand. So it was not like, okay, just push him left because I could go left. I could drive left. I was just not finishing left.
So it's kind of like the slippery eel, I think it's called. We're just going to go underneath and go with the opposite, with your strong hand on the
Yeah, most of the time I would drive to draw the help and pass the ball anyway.
Yeah. So. most memorable picture, back to the ATOs. We gotta do the ATOs here because the referees are calling technical fouls here.
Oh, my bad.
No. That was a joke. What was the best picture you took that comes to mind in nature? The first thing that comes to mind was the best scenic picture you took.
Well, I have a couple in my room. So, I think the one that comes to mind, my favorite one is Botswana, an elephant, going to drink water with sunset. Okay. I'm going to take you to it then. Cause it's right there. It is in my room. This one.
Oh, what, you took that?
Yeah.
That's
the favorite one that I took, and that was in Botswana.
Wow.
And the other favorite one is not here because it was taken later on. Those were like some of the first pictures that I took. So, yeah, that was my favorite one.
That's cool. Yeah. That's cool. So you took it
was one of a leopard, but because it has been raining, the leopard was all wet. So it's like a wet cat, you know, when they don't look grumpy. But he's like laying down on the tree. Maybe I'll try to send you the picture if you want. But he was like laying down on the tree. And because, you know, the tree, dead tree, but when they wet, they have like, you know, this color of the wood is really coming out with like all the hair all wet. It's one of my favorite as well.
That is cool. Do you use a specific high resolution camera for that?
I mean, yeah, I use the Canon, same one that I use basically that they shoot us at the NBA games. So the fast ones and a good resolution one.
Interesting. That's so cool, man. That's right down my alley. Pictures, taking pictures. I'm just not savvy with the big camera. I just use my iPhone, and I hope that it's gonna be a really, because the new iPhones, they're pretty good. I mean, you can.
It is better and better. Seriously, it is better and better. You can do a lot of stuff, but there is still some stuff that you can do with it.
Yeah, so. Night photography also, like night that just. So another project that I'm going to do is going to go see the Northern Lights at some point. That's something that I...
Yes, I want to do that too. I haven't found the time yet.
Best worthwhile personal investment.
Best what?
Worthwhile personal investment.
So personal investment or money-wise investing in something or investing in myself?
Personal, that you invest in yourself.
I mean, I would say, you know, just, but he was having fun, you know, it didn't feel like an investment, but just, you know, playing basketball that brought me to where I am and made me discover so many things that, you know, I have been, discovering now. So, yeah, that's what I would say.
Okay. Well, location of your boat right now?
New Zealand.
All right. Waiting to get out there.
Yeah.
The boat is waiting for you too to get out there.
Yep.
Best advice from your younger self to your older self.
Enjoy every moment. And I guess I told myself when I was young because I did it. I enjoyed every moment and I'm still enjoying every moment right now. You know, life is short. You know, you don't know what's coming on. And I think we all, and every, you know, basketball player also had this realization, you know, when the tragic accident of Kobe happened, this kind of stuff, you're like, you know, even after your life, and you're like, okay, it's the time to actually enjoy the time off that you have to do a lot of different things. And it can be cut short any time. So enjoy every day, you know.
You never know. You never know.
Yep.
What's something you believe that other people think that it's crazy? Is there something special you believe in that other people think that you're crazy for that one?
Work from the string theory.
Okay. The theory of everything.
The theory of everything. Yeah. No, I don't know. When you say that, that's the first thing that comes to mind, you know.
String theory, huh?
Well, no, I believe I'll go to space one day. I don't know how and how long. Hopefully space travel will become cheaper than it is now.
Yep.
But I believe it will go one day. Certainly hope so.
I think it will get there. Just listen to the episode with Lex Fridman and Jeff Bezos, and it's coming. It's going to get cheaper and cheaper, and at some point it's going to be out. We're going to be out there. One skill you wish you had?
I don't really do, but it would be different if I had selfish. If I was more selfish during my career, I would just have a bigger boat. That's the only difference. I think I would still do exactly the same thing I'm doing now. It's just the boat will be bigger, and I don't need to because it's the right size, and I don't need it to be bigger. But that's why I'm saying, like, if I had that selfishness in me.
Biggest pet peeve.
What's the pet peeves again?
Pet peeve is something that triggers you. Something like, for me, it's a wobbly coffee table. When I go to a cafe, I sit down and the coffee table is wobbly. I got to change the table. I just can't. That's a pet peeve of mine.
I am maniac sometimes for some stuff. So what would it be? I don't know, maybe where I sit. So when I'm on the boat, there is like specific seats or areas that I like to sit. And so basically it's like, oh, it's my spot, you know, a little bit like Sheldon in Big Bang Theory. Like, that's my spot. It's a little bit like that. And I know they make fun of me, especially, you know, like the Corona Bowl and stuff like that. They make fun when I have a sit. So everybody, yeah, knows would be that.
If you had the chance for a 60-second phone call, past or present, who would you call and what would you say?
Can we go way back in the past?
Yep, anybody.
When I wasn't born?
Anybody. Anybody that you would call, you know about right now from the past, and you had 60 seconds only.
Well, 60 seconds wouldn't be enough, but I would, you know, call Albert Einstein and ask him about the theory of everything. I don't think 60 seconds will be enough.
Definitely not. And the last thing I ask everybody is a Tim Ferriss question that he asked also some guests, and that's the favorite failure that you have in your past that you feel like that taught you the biggest lesson, and you kind of you cherish it more than you dread it. You know, that's a failure, but you feel like it brought you forward.
The loss in the finals in 2013, I think it was the foundation of winning in 14. Possibly with the national team, but definitely winning with the Spurs the next year, because we lost that year before. So, yeah, it was a failure at the time, and we felt so bad about it at the time. But in perspective, a year later, he helped us win the year after.
Yeah, that definitely. I was thinking that's going to be it, but that prepares you for. There's so many things to take away from that, and that's a whole different podcast about that one, probably.
Boris. Yes,
that's a classic. Boris, it was a great one, man. I appreciate you. I appreciate your time. I hope I was respectful to your time.
Yes, sounds good.
It was very insightful, and I'm sure our listeners and viewers on YouTube are going to enjoy this one. Classic.
All right. Sounds good, man.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. Thank you, everybody. Bye.